what is that English was added on? Colleagues, let us start and we're trying to delay for Meldam to attend. That demonstrates we are the only one. Your objection here will be rejected before even considered. But we can't vote. You can't vote.
I bang on you.
You bang on me. I'll defend you. No, I'll defend your right to speak. But also defend my right to say you are wrong. Okay. Now, colleagues, we should start our meeting. It shouldn't be a very, very long meeting. The amendment bill, it will take us 5 minutes to respond. And then there are the cause, disaster situation in the Western Cape. The team is here, the national is here. And then the Western Cape Forest is also here. We'll have also just a short report on the outcome of indigenous and traditional leaders. And then DM, you are also here. You may also assist us to capture some of the essence of the resolution. I know that there's a declaration already for what that is informing us about what happened in we attended. But we have to leave for the conclusion of the illness. Let us consider then the apologies, if any.
Apology from Mr. Kavita. He won't be attending the meeting.
Who's that, on the EFF?
Yes.
He has not been attending the meeting, you know. His apology, the standing apology. Just as usual, don't even call his name, we are recording his name. We'll just say EFF as usual. Not in the meeting. I think they're exhausted. These meetings are very exhaustive. So. Okay. Hey, welcome, colleagues. Welcome, Honorable Patel, Deputy Minister responsible for traditional affairs. Welcome to the Department and Disaster Management Chief. Welcome to members of Parliament. Yeah. Welcome also to our friends who are always with us in many meetings. Welcome. Thank you for coming. Let us continue with our meeting. The first item is a traditional leadership and governance framework amendment. The amendment I hear, last week there was a discussion on this amendment. The primary bill is there. We are amending it. This one is not a primary bill. We are amending the existing bill. You are amending the existing bill, Honorable Melham. Most welcome. Sitting next to my son would be a good idea.
It's not a good idea.
There are new clauses that are proposed by the department, also proposed by the team. Look at that. Even last meeting, you look at this matter very seriously. They always refuse based on some of the amendments. But we should today try our level best to conclude this amendment. We have to conclude. Proposed amendment, I think they are circulated to all members of the National Assembly. are they circulated? Well, I remember, do you have the code, the code of the new proposed amendment? Do you have the bill? You got the copy? Okay. Okay. Remember, do you have a copy? Okay, no, my favorite copy. That the matter? You have a copy? Inner circle can't have no copy. Actually, we are traditionally that. Have a copy. Okay, colleagues, let us then deal with this matter as follows. And I really wish that you won't take more than an hour of this. 25 minutes is sufficient for
Jake,
us.
Jake, can I just get a clarity?
Yes.
Are these amendments different from the ones that we discussed last week? So they're the same amendments we discussed last week. So why are we going to discuss them again?
No, we have to take a decision.
Okay. And then, Chair, my next question, which is also for clarity purposes, is from a procedural perspective. We don't have an amended draft of the bill. In other words, how can we take a decision as a committee if we don't have an amended draft of the bill? We're supposed to get a C version of the bill to approve, aren't we?
Under normal circumstances, I'm just saying that under normal circumstances, we have to look at what we are proposing as amendment. Once we have agreed on that, then they will accept in the bill.
Okay.
They will underline it. Because every, of
yep.
course, sometimes they bracket it, sometimes they underline it, sometimes they bold it. That will ensure that these are new amendments. But they can't put it before the committee we have agreed
okay.
with the amendment. Once we have agreed with the amendment, then they will put the but there will be indication that is amended version, because otherwise we can't correlate it if we have not agreed on the amendment as they are. Once we have agreed on the amendment, then the team in the office, then they work on them, they put the amendment as they are, then the bill comes to us, then we have to see whether the amendment corresponds directly with what we have agreed as a team.
So, Chair, then we will have to come back to again approve another draft of the bill.
You have to do that.
Yeah, no, I understand that. My point is this. I thought that this bill had to be approved before August by Parliament.
Yeah.
Well, it's not going to be at this rate. Because the last sitting of Parliament is on Thursday. It's still got to go to the NCOP. There's no way that this... I'm just trying to understand where we are in the process. That we're making amendments. There's another draft of the bill that has to come before the committee to be approved. At that point, it then goes to the House for approval. From the House, it then goes to the NCOP, which then goes through the same process.
The NCOP will decide whether they...
My point, Chair, is that there is absolutely no way that this bill is going to be approved before August. From a programming perspective, there is no way. So procedurally, I have to question why we are even bothering.
We must analyze the work that we're supposed to do. The rest will leave it to those who have to finalize. We must deal with what we're supposed to do and ensure that the report is clear on our side. And in fact, I don't think DMDs can take setting this few amendments can happen very within a through this meeting. The ones that are adopted, it should really take almost 1 hour to speak. It's not a very detailed issue, very few amendments. Take 1 hour issue. We can reconvene as a committee to adopt them. The process on our side is over. And then we put it into other meeting there.
And when?
Chair, I think my understanding for today was to adopt this framework bill, because actually we were supposed to adopt it last week, The only thing that came through the chair was that in the amendment that they presented, there was a clause that was not there initially. So in terms of the processes, we needed to go back to the House and ask permission for that. That's what we have done, Chair, on this day. So now that we have got that permission, we need to approve this in 2 minutes and then close. There's nothing that we need to go back. We have debated it, we have gone through it, we have clarified questions, we have asked questions, we have clarified, and we accepted. I thought today was that now that there's a new version and the House has adopted it, has permitted us to do it, then the matter after voting the legal advice to say, look, do that because of that clause. It was subsection B clause that was there that prevented us to adopt it last week. I therefore, Chair, want to move so that we finish our part. Our part was just that let's move for adoption.
Okay. Let us get to the corner. Yes.
Chair, on a point of order, we can't adopt the bill because we don't have a revised draft in front of us. To adopt a bill, you have to have the final draft of the bill in front of you. What we have here are a list of proposed amendments. We don't have a revised draft of the bill. How can we adopt a bill that we don't have in front of us?
No,
I wanted to make a small little proposal, Chairperson, to benefit you and those members who are not here last week. There's a motion that has been moved. Second, it seems like Member Mellon is questioning the very essence of what was supposed to be examined and continuing on. That we get a few legal people just to make a few comments before you may have taken up your mind, Chairperson. That will speed up the process.
No, but there are rules. Of Parliament are very clear. You look at the amendment, you agreed on the amendment. Once you have agreed on the amendment, the department insert the amendment in the original bill as amended. And the committee must say that we are happy with the amendment and the bill as amended. That is the final decision.
That's what we that's, isn't that what
that is, that is the final decision. I'm saying that is in terms of the rules. And that the rules must be followed correctly. That firstly, the amendment, we are saying that this amendment that was proposed last week were accepted. There was no move, of course, in the second. I think what we are doing today, we are moving and seconding the acceptance of it. Immediately, the department, they have to insert that in the amendment bill. Once they have accepted that in the amendment bill, comes back to us to accept it and approve.
Fine.
Once you have approved, then you go through the processes of Parliament. Parliament will see when it takes it through the MOP and everywhere. The point that Melham is raising is that given the fact that we may be adjourning very soon, is it possible for us to pass it before August? That's the point that is raised. Because the whole of July, in terms of the schedule, we won't be here. If you are not here for the whole of July, then you will have a negative impact on the bill, because the House won't be sitting to pass the bill in order for NSOP to consider the processes to move on. I think that's the point that I think was bringing to our attention. Not necessarily rejecting the amendment as agreed by the committee last week. It's just a procedural issue that we must look at here in terms of the department. And then because if the entire month we are not, there's no switching, we can't pass the bill outside the house. We have to take the bill to a formal sitting of the chamber, and then we put the bill there for acceptance, and it's referred then to the NSOP. The NSOP may take a decision that they don't need to follow everything because they agree generally. I think that's an issue that I think might have you raised in that point. Okay, no, it is a clear procedural issue in terms of the rules. That's how we should move on this issue. Yeah.
So I think that's how I understood the context of the discussion, and fully that covered me then. But obviously the issue is the department will immediately after the adoption of this text here, the amendment, or even set the number by the end of today to do the rest. But it's up to the committee to then decide whether it wants to reconvene the to then receive those inserted amendments as adopted by itself, and there will be great in the bill to then see if these are the elements that have adopted and are you happy to immediately solve it with them. Other processes will follow. I know that in that because Parliament is at end, we are all affected. But I'm not a committee from the stage when we begin to schedule. Just for the adoption of the bill now as amendments, the amendment will show you.
Thank you very much, Chair. Agree with the process, but just clarification, that amended document will not come from the department. Yes, the department is available to sit with the legal team of the department and assist in putting it together, but the document will not be coming from the department. It's strictly
a no. That's the community. That's an issue. Once the bill is before Parliament responsibility to make the thing finalized. The point that we are raising that we can't have the structure of Parliament only amending this bill without department also sitting there to consider that the issues that we are raising here, they're raised there. But everything now belongs to Parliament. But this department can still persuade us if they want to persuade us another issue, another meeting. I think that's the point that we are raising. And that's fine on that. It's not an issue. The point that once you adopt these new clauses that are proposed, we have to reconvene. That's the point that I wanted to raise. We have to reconvene. Even if you convene for 30 minutes, because we never agreed today, there's no sitting, as far as I know. There's no sitting. We can reconvene, adopt the amended, and then put it in the processes of the HCs and Parliament. It would be not really very difficult for us to do so. We can also reconvene tomorrow morning. And then that Friday is a working day. It's not a constituency day, it's a working day. We can convene tomorrow morning, meet at about 9:30. By 10 we'll be out. Therefore, no one will complain about the light.
Thursday tomorrow. Caucuses. But members be on this.
But tomorrow we can meet early. And once we meet early, then we consider this. I don't think this will take long. There are very few amendments to this on the original bill, because the whole issue really is just extension. That is the essence of this, just extension. Because there was a delay for passing the COIN's traditional leadership bill. Therefore, for the TRC to continue in kingship order, we must give them extension. And then once the bill, COIN's leadership bill, is considered and passed by Parliament, Honorable Deputy Minister, this bill will be repealed. It's a hold-on approach, really. Interim arrangement more than another thing. The main bill is the one that we have gone through, public hearing, everything. Because once that bill is accepted by the National Assembly, and of course the NSO of the Parliament, to repeal many of the bill about treaties that we have repealed. don't think that would be a problematic thing if we meet tomorrow. You can meet at 9. Tomorrow at 9, I think. Tomorrow at 9 will be. Half past 9 will be gone completely. In fact, if it takes us more than 5 minutes, we'll be wasting time. Because the staff of parliament, they have to put this and then finalize. But the department legal team also have to look just to ensure that we are in line with what we propose. Can we do it that way? We adopt it and then by tomorrow we meet at 9. Focus is general start at 10. And then we move on. Once you are through with it, then the other processes can work. But also Parliament may be reconvened for other reasons, depending on other issues that are raised more than other days. And therefore can put it in and ensure that we pass the change to the decision to take by the House and the referee. Simply means that our the report should be accepted again. The amendment, the team work on this amendment for the whole week, the whole meeting, everyone is taking the thematics. Which when all of it, we've had a traditional leadership system. Must be very good that I attending, otherwise must dissolve all this stuff. And then I think the NGO they will be very happy if we simply dissolve all this stuff. I think I'm persuaded by your view on that. It's not all this structure. Then there's no need for this in here wasting our time. But the reality that we can't do that. Therefore, we are persuaded by the constitutional that we are going to put it down. We will amend it accordingly, interimly. And then next year, not next year, before the end of the year, we must finalize the main thing. That is proposed, the primary one of leadership. Then this one should be repeated automatically. And then we earn the issue. Then the report is here, colleagues. We should then agree. The parliamentary legal team then shall read. The margin will start tomorrow at 9. We are meeting. I must meet with the people who give us this challenge. What we should do then, colleagues, is to accept the report was moved by Honorable Michel, seconded by Honorable Mandel. And what are the issues that you want to do more than what we've done? Madam, you reserve your right.
No, Chair. No, not this time.
Okay.
Chair, the DA wishes to object to clauses 1B, 1C, and 2 in its entirety. On the grounds that these amendments have not gone through a proper public participation procedure, on the grounds that these amendments that we have before us were from the National House of Traditional Leaders, and they are new amendments. They change fundamentally what was put out for public hearings and public participation. Not public hearings, public participation, which we've had input on. So there has been no input on these amendments as proposed by the National House of Traditional Leaders. So we object on those grounds. Secondly, Chair, as recorded in our meeting last week, we object on the grounds that this is removing rights from traditional communities and placing it in the hands of traditional councils. So that's the second cause of our concern. So as far as the recognition and the extension of traditional councils is concerned, no issue there. Problem with 1B and C, and I think it's 2. The numbering's a bit funny on this document. So I think it's the second new clause in its entirety.
Yeah, the 40% one.
No. It's on page 3, where it starts from new clause.
Yes.
I think it should be, I think the numbering should start with 2, where they amend section 3B of the Principal Act. So all of that in its entirety, on the grounds that I have outlined, public participation and removal of rights from traditional communities.
But is it not that we advertise the bill? The bill was advertised. Traditional leadership, like all other public participants, they participate in these processes. The fact that they are organized formation doesn't mean that they are not part of the broader public. They participated like any other person. They proposed this amendment like any other NGO can do so. And then this amendment was proposed because we advertised it. I think LEC came. Is it LEC? LEC came last week. They made their proposal. We may agree with their proposal or not, but they participated. Amakosi came also. They participated. Of course, you do reserve your right to object. It's just you are not objecting to the bill as a whole. You are objecting to the certain sections because of the that you are raising public hearings.
Chair, if I can just clarify. The National House of Traditional Leaders presented these amendments after all the other public participation had closed. In other words, the other NGOs and sectors of the community have not had an opportunity to comment on these proposed amendments that we are now going to adopt. So,
but do you want to go for a kill for interim arrangement?
Chair, I'm just raising it as an objection.
Okay.
I'm saying that this is, it's going to raise constitutional challenges down the line. And I have a concern about that.
Okay. Okay. The concerns are noted. Yeah,
but on this specific clause.
Clause?
I mean, the very same, the 14 issue there.
The new clause.
The 14 issue there.
Yeah.
I think it is unfair that we as a committee must support the House of Traditional Leaders against this very position that the people out there, they kept on saying the 40-60 issue is deplorable. And we agreed, and you also agreed, Chair. You even said, of course, it can't be because we are a constitutional state. But now here, last week, we allowed two traditional leaders here to prevail over the concerns of the majority out there. It's very unfair. It's really unfair. It's really unfair. We are a constitutional state. We can't allow traditional leaders to overrule people outside there. Very unfair. And it's unfortunate that there are political considerations here. This is my view that we are not supposed to be agreeing to what the two traditional leaders here presented last week against what has been said out there by people who are affected.
I have not
said my song during the chat. Mr. President, I want to urge that we should take the move forward because there was space enough created last week for people to raise their arguments. We can't be going through the same arguments again. Look at it, there's something new. Hoping and matching on the same spot forever. So I'm saying that these arguments that they presented were actually presented last week. Consider that everyone else made comments, including representatives from the National Office of Traditional Relations.
I'm sharing the same sentiment, Chair, that last week we have gone through the very same thing. The issue of the councillor, the formation, the structures, how it's going to work, it was presented and it was explained several times and we had different views up to a point where we agreed with this. The only thing in the framework, Chair, I want to report is We had even legal advisors last week that were taking us too close by close. everything went smooth, Chair, after our hot debate. The very same one that my colleagues on my right that is raising, he raised it last week. I don't want to say that he was, the matter was explained over and over and over to him, and he understood it after that.
No.
give me a chance, Chair. So, I don't know. Until we came to a point, Chair, where a new clause was inserted to this framework, that we said, no, this clause was not in the initial stage, so therefore we cannot adopt because of that. If we want to have any changes by now, then we need to seek the mandate of the House to do that. We drafted the document, the motion, we tabled it, all the parties that wanted to speak, they speak in the House last week, we tabled it, it was accepted, Chair. The House accepted it. What we need to do today is not to go through this. Is to do exactly what has done, Chair, to propose and I get a seconder. If we want to go to a vote, let's vote, Chair, and close the matter. Then allow the other process to continue, not to really spend the whole thing that we did. It took us more than 2 hours debating one meeting, Chair.
No,
yes.
Just second view that it is your choice and the kind of party to persuade them. The government leave a slave over the matter. He's still not convinced that is correct. The governing party's duty is always to convince even the most doubtful people. If Masibe is still not sure about what we are talking about, the point that I think we must not miss, this is amendment for the bill that was accepted by the chamber 2003. This amendment. The issue that you are raising, that you know, is coming to the bill that is going to repeal the very same bill that we are taking care of now. Don't forget that Khoisan and leadership bill, we are going to finalize that one. The 40-50 party hearing, we're about that. Then in that area is when we are going to have a discussion and express our views. At the moment, we are just amending the existing primary bill that was passed by the chamber in 2003. Then reserve your appoint for this year when we finalize the leadership bill.
Sorry, Chair, I have to respectfully disagree with you. We are amending the legislation as it currently stands. What happens in the future happens in the future, okay? And we'll worry about that when we come to the traditional and Khoisan leadership bill. But this is amending this bill. Now, amendments were proposed to this bill, and we are explaining why we are objecting to part of these amendments. And Honorable Matsepe proposed about 4 weeks ago that the 60-40 be swapped around. That amendment has not been considered by this committee. It has not been put before the committee. And yet the National House of Traditional Leaders can propose amendments, and they are accepted without question. Now, we are objecting to some of these amendments here. We are not objecting to all, and we are explaining why we are objecting. We discussed and we debated last week, I agree. And we don't need to rehave those debates. The ANC has their opinion, we have ours. My point is this, that we are objecting to certain of the clauses here, and Honorable Matsepe quite rightly has raised his concern that his proposed amendment of 60-40 being swapped around, that 40% be appointed and 60% be democratically elected, has not been put before the committee.
No, let us put it now. Let's put it now. Okay. Let us put it now, because otherwise I think the issue that you are raising is valid. That they must put a point that 60-40, I thought you were persuaded us and I agree with you. That as we finalize the core and leadership bill, that matter would be considered favorable by all of us. But for the amendment of the existing law, we should allow it to go as it is, because we don't want to disrupt the setting of this TIC. That's the main issue that is great. But we can put it anyway. And then surely, I think we'll be persuaded as we go to another area.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, we put it here. You want 40, 60? 40. 40 selected.
I explained you not here last week. I explained that.
No, I know.
The 40, 60 issue is the blueprint from the farm to state. Isn't that about that? I mean, it's been young and done and passed it with the participation already. It's a deportation from the farm to state policy.
No, that there is absolutely no question that the issue is a very pertinent issue. The members of the society in public hearings in many corners of the country raised the issue. None of us is saying that. But the point that we are saying that we are amending the existing law. Because we are amending the existing law, it's always preferable not to tamper with it in a substantive manner. Because we have a bill already that is ready for us to finalize to deal with 60-40. And then it seems 60-40 reserve it for that bill. No. At the moment, we are not putting 60-40 in the manner initial proposal. But we are not closing our mind that as we finalize the bill next week, and we start on August 4th. August 1st and 4th to be finalizing that bill. In fact, it will be even long before even this bill anyway operates. And they will be amending it already, accordingly. But we should move on that area, Bamanzi. I don't think you want to. We have noted your objection. We appreciate your position. We are accepting the traditional leadership system in our country. That is relevant, is necessary, it must work. And therefore, we are not against the traditional leadership. We are trying to balance the 50-50 approach, the elected and the appointed, or selected by the king. Now, we could engage in that in the next meeting. In fact, the meeting was at the 1st to 4th of August this year. As we come back, we are finalizing the main bill, the bill that is going to repeal the very same bill that we are fighting on. And then that issue that we are raising is going to be finalized as we deal with it then. Okay. Let us move, colleagues, and thank you very much, Nadema Sip. Your views are welcome. We'll deal with it as we come to the finalization. Public participated anyway, general on this. That bet was made. People who wanted to come, they came. They made some proposal and presentation. We capture some of the issues that they propose, some of the issues of course that they propose. There are people who don't want traditional system of governance in our country. Then we can't violate the constitution that recognizes them. What we are trying to do is to manage it in a manner that assists the society to move forward. The constitution is very clear. We recognize this system. Then even if we don't like them, we must change the constitution then. National Assembly is ready to change the constitution, but as it stands, you can't do so. Therefore, we must work with what we have in terms of the constitution. This bill, anyway, we are amending it precisely because of that reason. Mr. Demasip, I'm happy now that we are happy, all of us. We must always persuade you. The Bantu stand was a very problematic system. Anything that comes with those Bantu stand, I know that makes you really, you go always berserk and deal with this issue. Colleagues, we agreed with the report. It has been moved. Mthethwa, seconded by Mamleg. Check the objection that is raised, that some clauses that are raised by Honorable Melham, Honorable Masipe, will come back to the bigger issue that we are raising. Tomorrow we are meeting at 9 in the morning. We finalize then this. I think we won't take the staff of Parliament more than 1 hour really to insert this. DM, Amakosi, very clear, Amakosi must deal with it. The 50-50 issue is something that we are going to discuss because we've got very strong views anyway on some of the issues on the outside. Matipa is not alone on this one. General, the society has raised very serious objections.
but we'll come to it as we deal with the college side, traditional leadership. Okay, colleagues, agreed on this one. Mason, you are happy. Abdube, happy. Mchaifa, happy. Kosiang, you are happy. Sisi, Dadi Masipa. Madam is not against traditional system of cabinet. He wants to democratize it. And all of us will agree that it must be democratized. The difference is in style and language. Not in such depth. It's just style and language. Which one you put better? It's not such depth. Because the substance is that they are there, they are existing, you can't get rid of them. How you manage them then? Honorable Melham, I think you are happy?
No, Chair, I'm not happy, but you're going to do it anyway.
We note it, Okay. Let us move on. Thank you very much. Can we move to item number 2 on our agenda, briefly? On the disaster situation in the Western Cape. Honorable Deputy Minister, you want to introduce the team?
No. Thank you very much. Yes, I will be introducing the team. And I just want to remark that we thank the committee for inviting the input from the department and the National Disaster Center, both national and in the Western Cape. Because of the devastation that this disaster had caused in the country. It started as a storms, and we thought it was just going to be rain, and the western part of Western Cape did experience those storms and rain. However, in the eastern side, obviously, the gale force wind, as it was picking up, it came with fire itself. So I think that presentation will be presented on the screen. We had fortunately visited the areas with the minister and the premier of the Western Cape and the cabinet of Western Cape also had a meeting in that area and they joined us on site visits to both formal and informal houses. We saw the devastation, it was quite big, and in Neisner. And then a bit visit to the Plagenberg and also into the Bito municipality. We are still to go with the minister to the Western Cape because they did cross over from Western Cape and then hit certain municipalities such as Sarah Bartman, Nelson Mandela Bay, and then others. We still have to go into those sites also to go and see the damage and how the municipalities, the disaster centers were able to deal with the issues. And really begin to comprehend with the issues of natural disasters and how global warming is now beginning to be an impact in South Africa and how regions are doing. And I think I must say, during those visits, we did thank the firefighters for the standing work that they did and also the teams of the disaster centers and the municipalities in the manner in which they coordinated their work. They had prevented worse scenarios not to hit us. And I think we've seen what happened in Portugal recently. The death toll in South Africa is 7. And whereas in Portugal, it's over 62, as we've seen. So it means, therefore, that those firefighters and the teams and the municipalities coordinating that particular work had done so well that they could have prevented that death toll. However, the team is here to present. We've got Ms. N. Rowa, the acting head of the National Disaster Management Center, who has been throughout in the absence of the head who had undertaken an international visit and on leave that has been acting and then really in the heat of it. And she's here to present the team. And we also have Colin Daniel, the head of the Western Cape Provincial Disaster Management Center, and the other officials of the department are also together. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I think we should invite them to take us through what are the issues.
morning, Chairperson and committee members. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. I will just give a brief overview and introduce the matter to the committee, and Mr. Colin Diner will then take you through to the detailed presentation with some interesting images and the video that he will present. Okay, so basically, my presentation will just quickly cover the purpose, the background, some of the South Fires Eden District, support provided by the national government departments, and then a high-level summary of the damages and losses associated with severe weather South Fires that came from preliminary assessment, and then the national government intervention. If I look at the purpose, basically we were requested to provide you with some information on the incidents that happened, and then also give you an outline of the support provided by the national department responding to these disasters. I would also like to outline key measures that national departments will put in place in supporting the relief, recovery, rehabilitation and reconstruction initiative. Initiative that is currently happening. So just to give you a brief background on the incident of the storms and the severe weather, the South African Weather Service has predicted cold fronts that were experienced in the Western Cape province in early June. And in summary, they predicted an intense cold front to affect the Western Cape, sustained gale force winds in all the coastal areas, very high and rough sea conditions and possible storm surges, considerable rainfall and snowfall. That was around the 5th of June, and so all the disaster management structures were put on high alert to prepare for the severe weather. The Western Cape Provincial Disaster Management Centre in particular disseminated early warnings to their disaster management key role players in the province and also to the general public. And following engagement with the leadership of the province, a decision was also made to close all the schools on the 7th of June. I think that was well communicated and well received in order to reduce possible loss of lives and injuries, as well as to reduce traffic congestion, which may hamper emergency operation efforts. So the PMC activated the joint operations to monitor the effects of the severe weather and all the key role players that were involved in the operation. They identified three incident priorities, which is quite common with regards to dealing with disasters and preparing for disaster incidents, and that is to provide for safety and welfare of public and response personnel, to maximize the protection of public health and welfare, and to ensure stability of critical infrastructure. The storm then made landfall on the 7th of June and resulted in damages relating to roofs that were blown off, damage to informal structures, it uprooted trees, damage to schools and other critical infrastructure across the province. For that severe weather event, a total of 5 people lost their lives due to the storms. All evacuated residents who were housed in temporary shelter had in the meantime returned to their homes, except in Cape Town Hope Bay, the Imizamo, where 17 families are still housed in temporary housing. You will remember that earlier this year they were also facing the devastating fires that occurred in that informal settlement. Then, as everybody was ready and prepared for the severe storm, another incident started to unfold in Eden District, and that was the fires, the Veld fires. It began on the evening of the 6th of June, and by the 7th consisted of 26 fires in the area. These fires were fanned towards residential areas by strong winds from a cyclone to the west. The towns, several of the towns within the area, Belvedere, Brenton-on-Sea, and Reenendaal were evacuated. Also after news that a family of 3 passed away during the night of the fire. Go George bus service was activated to assist with evacuation, and eventually in total, at this stage, 408 formal houses or structures and 200 informal dwellings were destroyed by the Veld fires in late entire municipality, another 27 formal structures were damaged and destroyed. It must also be noted that the Nijna Hospital was evacuated and the medical command post and treatment area was established. So all these measures were put in place to deal with the situation, and it was managed by the, primarily managed by the Disaster Management Center of Eden, who supported the local disaster management structures in Nijna. In total, 6 people lost their lives as a result of the Veld fire, and another person suffered a heart attack while running away from the fire in Nijna. There was also another person that died as a result of the fires in the Vitou local municipality that was a volunteer in the service. And so a total number of 7 people lost their lives, unfortunately. Then I think it is important to note that the fires, the Veld fires in the Eden district, can be regarded as one of the largest operational deployment of firefighting resources and personnel in a single incident in South Africa's history. And you can see in the table how many people were deployed on which days. So by the end of the period, or the peak of the period on the 11th of June, there were 88 command staff, 920 firefighters from across the country, 78 vehicles, fire vehicles, and also 19 buses. But Mr. Colin Diner will give you more detail on these deployment structures. So currently the Veld fires have been extinguished within the district, but we do also see some flare-ups every now and then, but it is basically contained. In terms of the National Department's support, as you know, the purpose of the Disaster Management Center, the National Center, its objective is to promote an integrated and coordinated system of disaster management across the spheres of government with all sectors and civil society and communities. So the center is located within the Department of Cooperative Governance, and we were also participating in the overall coordination of these disasters. COCTA and the NDMC coordinated the national response, and several meetings of the National Joint Operations and Intelligence Structures, that is the NAC Joint, the Priority Committee on Disaster Management, were convened, and it was co-chaired by the NDMC and the South African Police Service to ensure that we provide the necessary support to the Western Provincial Disaster Management Centers and the center and the structures on the ground. In summary then, the support was by providing dissemination of early warnings and regular communication to the public. The NDMC held interviews with the media to provide updates as well as communicate the conditions to the general public, and COCTA also regularly issued media statements to ensure that people are aware of what is the situation, what is going on. We also activated the aerial resources from the South African National Defence Force to be deployed to the Western Cape and also later on to the Eastern Cape to support the efforts there. The NDMC also deployed staff to the various centers to support if necessary, and currently they have been deployed to assist in the Eastern Cape to manage the situation in the Kalkama local municipality. The table there just gives a preliminary summary of damages and losses associated with the severe weather and Veld fires. It must be noted that it's a preliminary assessment, and it does not include the losses in the private sector, because those will be dealt with by the insurance companies, and it really already amounts to billions. But in terms of the public infrastructure, all the departments and the sectors have listed some of the losses that they have already incurred, and it amounts to 285 in excess of 285 million rand already. But detailed assessments will follow and will be verified. There are teams doing those assessments from the various sectors, and they will be ongoing for the next 2 weeks. So in terms of national government intervention, we will assist the province through ongoing monitoring and support to the province regarding relief and mop-up operations. The Community Works Program will also support these operations. We will assist with the damage assessment and verification. We will support the emergency repairs to critical infrastructure through the National Disaster Management Center grant funding that is provided for in our legislation and in the DORA. We will support ongoing humanitarian operations and specifically also support and expedite the processes of disaster declaration and classification, because that can also assist in further release of resources. We will also continue to support the province for firefighting and mitigating for aerial support, to mitigate possible future risks or further risks within the province, but also, as I indicated, in the Eastern Cape province, where there are also some fire risks in some of the plantations. The regular weather forecast by source and the dissemination of weather updates with precautionary measures and informed decision-making by community, we will continue to do that, and also provide advice to the municipality and other role players with regards to technical support through our MISA program in the department, and also provide project management support where required. So I think in conclusion, from a national perspective, we would like to congratulate and commend the work that has been done by the various disaster management structures across the province. The Naisna local municipality, the Pitou local municipality, the Eden district municipality, and also the Western Cape Provincial Disaster Management Centre. So we will continue to work with the province to assess and verify the damages, and we will support the emergency repairs to the critical infrastructure through our grant funding processes. We are also engaging with all the key sector departments that were affected. As we speak, they're having a meeting today at the National Disaster Management Centre to assess the situation and indicate what kind of support they can provide from the various funding with mechanisms within their own departments as well. So, on that, I think that is just a brief overview. I will hand over to Mr. Colin Diner, who is the head of the Provincial Disaster Management Centre, to provide you with a detailed presentation. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Honourable Deputy Minister, Honourable Chair and members. Anae has covered pretty much an overview. What I'll do is give a bit more of an operational perspective to the incident. We were the primary command and control structure within the process, and so from that perspective I might be repeating one or two things that she mentioned, but I'll give it from a more operational perspective. So we received on the 5th of June the severe weather warning from the South African Weather Services, and what we were told at that point was in 30 years the South African Weather Services had not seen a weather system of this nature. And for that reason, they felt that it was important. I mean, to give you an idea, I've actually received two gale force warnings while I've been sitting here for the Western Cape. So we received that on a fairly common basis. However, we received this warning that they felt that we really needed to focus on the fact that this was going to create not only a strong wind scenario, but that we would also have severe weather in terms of storm surges as well as snowfalls coming in behind the system that would cause the problems. Unfortunately, we did not receive the amount of rain that we felt we were going to have, because as you are aware, we are still gives you an indication of the modeling that they did in terms of the weather system and how it was going to adjust. It's quite a severe system. It really was a worst-case scenario. The surface winds that we expected, and I think what's important to mention here, is the expected winds were Wednesday, 7 June at 1400 standard time until the 2300 would be the wind systems. Now, a wind of about 50 knots is about 100 kilometers an hour. Now, we do get a lot of very strong winds over this period. We do receive strong winds over the summertime. It causes a huge problem for our fire season. The difference here was that when you get a wind coming through that lasts possibly 2 or 3 hours, it would dislodge, but it would just move on, and you would then be able to repair. The situation here is this wind was expected to last for 36 hours, which meant that it would dislodge, but it would also cause substantial damage, and that was where our largest concerns were. If you look at the next picture, this was the snowfall that we were expecting for 6 hours, ending Thursday, 6 June at 2 a.m. Our main concerns here were the high-lying areas that where people would be affected by the very cold weather that was going to come in. So we did a number of preparation initiatives. We requested an urgent meeting with the provincial top management on the 6th of June, which was chaired by the provincial DG, and we informed that we have three major concerns. The first one is informal settlements, in specifically to because of the wind situation, the coastal low-lying areas due to the storm surges, and then the schools. And it was not so much the concern around the school structures themselves, but the fact that people had to commute from various areas throughout the province to the various schools. And that was the first concern we had. The second concern that we had was if we need to respond large numbers of emergency services all over the city and in different parts of the province, it would be more favorable for us to have available roads, etc., and not to have that congestion that comes together with schools. So we briefed the Premier, we requested the Minister of Education in the province to close the schools on the 7th of June, and they did make that decision. And I also want to mention that that was probably the one decision which saved a lot of lives, but also made it a lot easier for us to be able to get to all the incidents as they took place. We, as I mentioned, issued public warnings by radio, by various media. We convened our Joint Operational Committee, which I will give you more information on. And then the warnings are very accurate in terms of time. So we set everything in place, and then we requested all the districts, as well as the City of Cape Town and ourselves, to activate our disaster management centres at 2200 on the Tuesday evening. We requested NAT joints at this stage through the National Disaster Management Centre to place military aircraft on standby. At that stage, we were not aware that we would have a fire. So they were placed on standby mostly for search and rescue work and possibly for disaster relief work if that was necessary the following day. We have a technical rescue team which we activated. So everything was pretty much put on standby in anticipation of what was going to happen. Our Joint Operational Committee, and I mentioned the incident priorities, the strategic objectives were to maintain a situational awareness and through a planned process for tasking, collecting, processing, analysing and dissemination of information, to manage a coordinated interagency response, which I think was the most important aspect, to make sure that the public, stakeholders and the media are informed of what response activities we were carrying out, to identify and address social, political and economic priorities, and to support and coordinate any requests for assistance. This gives you an indication of our joint operational activation. We have, within the province, as every province has, a provincial disaster management advisory forum, which includes all various role players who are involved in disaster management. We spend a huge amount of time in planning. The Western Cape is a very disaster-prone province, and at the current moment, we are dealing with in excess of 7 declared disasters of various types. So. We have all these players who are really very supportive and assist us when we really need to call them in. So at 2200, we activated soon after the storm caught the western side of the province. And this is not an exhaustive list, but this just gives you an indication of the kind of incidents that we followed. So we had widespread incidents happening from the basically from the peninsula all the way up the west coast. We had incidents taking place. a number of buildings lost roofs. We unfortunately had the fatalities that Anne alluded to. We had to evacuate people from informal settlements in Malmesbury. We had to close Chapman's Peak and the Huguenot Tunnel. A number of the issues, Metro Rail was delayed. We had fairly large electricity disruptions, but as I say, because of the fact that we had the schools closed on the Wednesday, the roads were open and we were able to move resources into various places to be able to carry out the kind of relief operations that we needed to. This gives an indication of the storm damage that took place around the metro, and it was of various natures, mostly roofs being damaged, trees being uprooted, roads being closed, etc. is what we found. So again, our preliminary assessments, and this is just for the severe weather. We've not finalized that yet. We've got teams working at this stage intensely every day on trying to finalize the various damages that have been caused. Municipal infrastructure damage of 5.7 million at the moment. Department of Education damage of 129 million. House facilities of 1.25 million. And as Anne mentioned, there were still a number of people who were housed in temporary shelters that have returned to their homes. The Imazama Yetu incident, obviously you will recall the fire that we had there a couple of months ago. There are still people there that are being housed temporarily, and obviously those people still have to receive relief and assistance as far as temporary accommodation is concerned. If I can just go back to that slide, one of the things that started coming up was that we were picking up that there were felt fires in the Eden district. Now, I'd like to mention that it's not extraordinary this time of year. We get fires in the Eden District. The Western Cape fire season generally, wildfire season, is generally from the beginning of December to the end of March. This year was our most intense fire season. We had to respond to 17,000 fires in that period, and we also had carried out 2,000 air operations. So it is a period that the Southern Cape is in a different weather pattern, so they have fires virtually all year round. The reason that we had these intense fires was because of the fact that we had the winds. So it's not unnatural for us to have fires in that region this time of year. We are very fortunate in our disaster center that we have fairly sophisticated satellite imagery from which we get from NASA in the USA, which was able to provide us with quite accurate imagery around the spread of the fire, the winds, and it allows us to make certain predictions in terms of where the fire will be reaching, and in that regard we can actually then plan our fire operations a lot better, and that just gives you an indication of what that would look like. So then on the 6th of June the fires started. On the 7th of June there was around 28 fires burning, and we received a request from assistance from the Eden District Municipality. Wildfires obviously being a function of district municipalities over all the services at that stage responded. Evacuation started. We contacted the Department of Public Works and Transport, the provincial department. They have the public works system called Go George, which is in the city of George, and we requested them to take all those buses and move them in. At that stage, the problem was that we couldn't get into Leisner. The N2 was closed. So we actually had to move resources in to clear the road for us and make sure that we could get the vehicles in. We couldn't move people away from Leisner. So what we did was we removed them to specific areas, to sports complex as well as to the beach in Renton-on-Sea, and then we got the NSRI to come in from this ocean side and move people away to safety. So there was a lot of cooperation from people in terms of how this was done. A number of fatalities occurred, four fatalities at this stage. The hospital was evacuated. We set up a medical command post. The private sector also came in and allowed us to move all the critical cases to the Leisner Life Hospital. And then we started activating additional firefighters. The municipalities around were very cooperative. The Overberg District provided extra fire trucks as well as vehicles. The city of Cape Town provided 8 additional vehicles and staff. What we did is we closed all the nature reserves of Cape Nature. And now the Cape Nature Rangers are very good firefighters because that's what they do most of the time in the summer. We were able to withdraw all those staff members. Volunteer Wildfire Services responded. And we were able to then start moving a large amount of firefighters into it. Also at this stage, we'd like to recognize Working on Fire, who's started activating teams from as far as Mpumalanga, KwaZulu-Natal, We have a very good agreement with them. We use them extensively during our fire season, so it was a process that we could start running. And then, of course, the Air Force assistance. Now, you all know that at this stage, one of the firefighters, Bradley Richards, and another firefighter, Ian Bernard, were injured in a fire when the fire turned. Mr. Richards received 70% burns, and Mr. Bernard, 50%. Unfortunately, Mr. Richards succumbed to his wounds. In our world, we very much a family. So when this happened, it did create, it's something that everybody has to adjust to. That's the picture of the command center having a moment of silence when we heard of his death. So then the operations continued on the 8th of June, where operations and humanitarian support continued. We received the body of a 3-year-old child was found in the rubble, and 20 buildings were destroyed in Plettenberg Bay. On the 9th of June, we deployed what we call a Type 1 incident management team. That is where we have specialists in all the various areas of wildland firefighting. They were put together, and we started working on the firefighter. As I said, Mr. Richards passed away. But on the 9th of June, we were actually quite fortunate that 85% of the fire had been contained. Unfortunately, we received the warning that on the 10th of June, we would have a very large gale force wind coming through the area. And at about 12 o'clock, that gale force wind hit, and we had to remove all our aircraft. We had to land all our aircraft. We had to remove all our firefighters off the various fire lines. Fortunately, when the wind subsided, which was about 3 hours, we were able to put our staff back on. We unfortunately lost a person who tried to run away from the fire, and we were able to contain the fire by 1900. The 11th of June was the big day. I'll speak about that a little bit later, but that's when we really got control over the fire. And those 2 days, 11 and 12 June, were the most critical days for us in terms of actually getting control over the incident. I'm hoping this is going to work. This just gives you a very quick indication of the fire, which started right at the top, and as every color is a different day, as it spread over. Obviously, we'll leave this with you, but it gives you an indication, really, of the fire started fairly far up north and then how it spread across to the various areas. Now, as I mentioned, this was the largest operational deployment of firefighting resources and personnel in a single incident in South Africa's history. Now, we have a larger deployment over our summer season, but that is for a significant amount of fires. This was for one incident, and I think it's a tribute to the entire country because it was not a Western Cape response. We received assistance from all over, and that allowed us. I think the important thing is that on the 6th of June, the only resources that were available was one helicopter and the emergency services of the various municipalities. By the 11th of June, we had a total of 1,106 people actually dealing with the fire. 8 aircraft from the South African National Defence Force and 6 from Working on Fire, which were able to move in. And a lot of this is due to the planning that gets done and the preparation that gets put into place. The preliminary damages, as I said, these are preliminary at the moment, so I don't think we need to spend too much time on it. We will certainly make the final damage assessments finished when or available once we're done with them. I'd like to mention that Eskom and Telkom suffered substantial damages themselves. We actually lost communication at one point. Fortunately, we had backup emergency communications that allowed us to continue communicating with our resources. The disaster assessments, the declaration, so the Nasna and Bitto areas were declared disasters for the fire. The assessment and verification process is ongoing. We had an extraordinary cabinet meeting where the national minister was also and deputy minister were also at last week in Nasna, where it was supported that Nasna and Bitto would be declared local states of disaster. And the Swartland Hospital, which burned down quite a while ago, we've actually requested for that also to be declared a local disaster. The damage on that, I think at this stage, is in the region of 120 million rand. So the assessments and verifications are taking place. I may have mentioned how that is happening. We have the provincial government, the Department of Health, Treasury, and the various municipalities working with us. National Disaster Management are in the area, and until the end of next week, they will be working with us. We actually did request, and we were approved for a provincial state of disaster for the drought. this really mean that we're going to have to take a step back and include the damages now as well into that? So we are doing emergency repairs to critical infrastructure and services. We've brought a number of generators in to make sure that water is continuing, that sewer systems are being looked after. We may continuing with mopping up operations. I received the message that we did have two fires there this morning, but they were dealt with. The disaster declarations I've discussed. We are continuing, although the humanitarian relief, I'd like to mention that we received well in excess of 250 tons of aid. We've also considered that the issues in areas like Imazamia 2, like Malmesbury, also need that aid. So we've moved a lot of that aid across to areas where the need has been larger. There's a number of initiatives. We are doing an operation tomorrow where we're going to be flying over the area and we're going to be doing an assessment of the ground density, because the problem with Nazna is you get a lot of landslides there. And with there not being any ground cover now, that is a very real risk. So we're addressing that issue as we speak. We're continuing to provide security. There are secondary health impacts, obviously, in a situation like this, and there is a number of trauma support and trauma counseling that has to happen, that the province have activated their resources. These are just a few pictures. I know there's been a lot of pictures that have been in the media, but this, I think, just gives it more from a fire service perspective to give you an indication of what this situation was like for the operational staff on the ground. And you could see the situation where you had a single house burning in between a group of other houses, which was actually quite an interesting phenomenon. This picture here is of the command center on the morning of the 11th of June. We had all the resources in place. We had all the staff in place. The weather conditions were good, and we made the call where we said, today is the day. Today is the day that we're going to win. And that is the day that everybody pulled together. We put all our resources in place, and that was the next day's newspaper headline, where we felt that we had achieved the desired result in this operation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, GM.
No, thank you very much. I can like the presentation to the honorable member, but just to also thank the department that has some of the houses are rubbish. There's no business thinking of, because the guests didn't attack the smaller houses. They are stepped in and destroyed everything for our life. They all go to where the subcontractors are. The whole that are actually taking over the house, not to be completely working as far as we have, you know, thinking as that. And I wish the committee could, at some point, just go there.
That's
a lesson that we could share with other colleagues, with other provinces, to say we need to really invest in the state of readiness around dealing with the disaster. And I think this is one lesson that should be for all of us in South Africa. And the President also did good with me, and I'm also joined by the similar ministers that will be, and others are now beginning to look in to the mainland. And one hearing issue that we think by South Africans is an issue of our own state of readiness psychologically and otherwise. And when awareness warning comes, are we responding to those warnings as people? Or we just stay in our eyes but also basic skills in the community to me when they are flat. I remember when I was caught up in the storms last year, myself,
able to swim. And others were swimming to go and rescue others, and I was not able to swim and go and rescue
women.
I had to be lifted by my protectors to a safe spot. So swimming does have an interest deal within communities, you ought to be particularly among young people, so that when disaster hits, we don't all run. You will be able to have young men who can go and rescue the elders, the disabled, the children, and the men. But I think in today's life, that everyone will run for their dear life and leaving their old grandfather and grandmother. And then tomorrow you will be able to run away. You didn't know what to do. So those are the basic things that we have identified when we're in National, that I think there must be a national effort and a consciousness amongst our people that just have practical basics with paramedics, when a person is in that, how to manage those people, you know, those basic elements that human beings must possess in communities, particularly investing in the youth and ensuring that, so that by the time the disaster people come, there has been some kind of rescue and evacuation that has happened, and then they take over the professional way of doing things. And also thanks to Gift of Givers, I think they've done a very wonderful work in the feeding and coordination, ensuring that the goods that are received from furniture, clothes, food, are able to go to the victims in an orderly, managed way, and there's been no disruptions for the victims. Thank you very much.
No, thank you very much. That the mother can swim all that. She's a good swimmer. I'm a good swimmer, 1 inch of scale river, not a plan.
Chair, I just want to ask some questions, but before I do, I want to commend everyone that's been involved in this, the department, the National Disaster Management Center, the Western Cape Provincial Disaster Management Center, and basically everyone that's been involved in addressing this, because I think they've done a fantastic job in dealing with a very difficult situation. I also want to extend my condolences to those who have lost their lives and the families of those who have lost their lives. Chair, I have several questions. First of all, to Mr. Diner, what is the current status of the flare-ups? I see that as of this morning, EWN are reporting that there are flare-ups today in the Knysna area. Then perhaps Ms. Brewer could answer several questions. The first is, what is the status of the investigation into the causes of this fire? There were rumors and allegations being made, and I'm not going to throw them out here, but perhaps you could update us as to the status of that investigation. Secondly, I am concerned, if we knew that this is a likely scenario, what was done to pre-position resources to address, and particularly in the case of the fire, I accept that we had multiple disasters happening at the same time, but particularly in the case of the fire, and I'm looking specifically at the aerial resources from the SANDF. What was done to pre-position those or to make those available? How long did it take for them to get on site and operational? And I understand that there were strong winds that prevented them from operating. But how long did it take to actually get them operational? My final question relates to nothing in what I've seen here today talks about the fire spreading into the Eastern Cape. And we know that there was a lot of devastation in Nelson Mandela Bay, in the Van Stadens area, and surrounds. And has that been factored in? Was that part of your response? I don't see anything mentioned about that yet. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. I also want to join those that comment the Chief. But I want also, Chair, to get a sense of Knysna. What? How many schools that are affected? And what is happening with those kids that are there? And also the issue of the industries in that area. How many industries that were burned down? And also, do you count them in terms of the job losses that is also lost due to that fire? So not much is being said around those two.
sectors, energy, and they invited him to resources.
Just a sense, I know that the numbers of the settlement sector have been bent down to say about around 200, plus formal housing, over 400. Just the intervention on what happened after in terms of the building plans.
Chair, I can possibly answer a few of the questions that the honourable member asked as well. The current status of the flare-ups is we do have some areas, but we felt that when we did demobilise the operation, that where the fires were burning, that there was no significant threat that it would be returning to the specific areas. They are going to be continuous flare-ups, and today we've received warnings again. To keep the aircraft, we do have some aircraft still there, and we do have some resources still there that we're keeping. It's a very expensive operation. We've moved most of the resources to the Eastern Cape, and then a lot of the Air Force resources have not gone back up to the other provinces, but we've moved them to the city of Cape Town, so that would be a two-hour response if required. So although we feel that we will get fires, it's a fire-prone area, we have our standard resources there. But we will, at this stage, we feel that we probably do have control over it. It's a very difficult thing to manage, but with the kind of resources at our disposal. As far as the pre-positioning of resources is concerned, we work together with the Working on Fire Aerial Support Program. And what happens is the aircraft are in the Cape summer, or in the summer season they're in the Western Cape, and then they move to the other provinces in the winter because that's when they have their fire season. The province spends in excess of 10 million rand a year contracting the aircraft, and that is on top of a national sponsorship as well. It would be very difficult for us. A lot of the aircraft we actually had to release, and that is from contractors who, forestry companies, etc., who had contracted them. So we actually had to speak to those people to release them. There's not a huge resource as far as that is concerned. I must honestly say that we did not expect a fire of this nature. The reports that we received were that it would be together with a lot of rain, and even weather services are saying to us that there was a lot less rain than what they expected. So we did not expect it to cause the fire that it did cause. It's obviously something that we will learn from going forward, but it's not something that we expected. We did pre-position a lot of resources, and of course, realizing that the wind would be the way it is, you can't operate aircraft in that kind of weather, as the member mentioned. So we try to position them in the most advantageous position, but we feel that the response time of literally 24 hours from since the incident really got to a level, which we call a level one incident, to actually having all the, when the wind dropped, we were able to start firefighting operations. The 408 houses were damaged while the wind was blowing. And it, you know, you can have as we got a lot of assistance, offers for assistance, from, for example, Gauteng, from various other provinces. And the fact of the matter is, we did have enough firefighters. It's the conditions that decides with how you can use them. As far as the Eastern Cape is concerned, that was actually a separate fire. It was not the same fire that spread into the Eastern Cape. It was separate fires that happened that were fanned by the same winds. So we didn't actually see a full blow and blow over into the other provinces. But what we did was we did assist the Eastern Cape. We did what we call a joint multi-agency command, where I was in communication with the Eastern Cape's command post from the Saturday evening when their problems really started. And then we decided where we could release resources, we moved those resources to the Eastern Cape. As far as the schools, the latest we have is that 170 schools were affected. It was most of them were affected because of the weather, because of the wind, etc. None of them have had to close fully. The only ones that have had to close are the ones that were affected by the damage, the fire damage. The assessments are continuing. A lot of work is being done to make it safe for the children to attend and for the schools to continue. So as far as it, the most fires, the areas Brenton-on-Sea, Belvedere, Belvedere Heights, Riedendal were mostly residential areas. So I don't have all the details of industry, but there was no significant damage to industry. The hotel that was mentioned by the Deputy Minister, of course, there is a loss of jobs, and there will be a loss of jobs in certain of the agricultural areas, which is an effect. But the provincial government has looked at what we're calling a Build Back Better program, and that is so that we can make sure that whatever we're going to put back into the area is going to be more resilient, and that they need to address the NISNA standing up, if I can use that term, and being able to become a functional municipality again. We didn't have much informal settlement damage, and it was, I think a lot of the message that went out to the public was that there was a lot of destitute people, which in fact, the Inazamo-Yetu fire, I was saying to Anay earlier, was probably 10 times bigger in terms of informal settlement damage. So our focus on assisting in the informal settlements was there, everybody was taken care of. I think there's only about 30 odd people that are still, that we still have to assist in that area. And we obviously are assisting the people that were affected by providing them with resources to rebuild the damage that took place. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, in addition, with regards to the status of the causes of the fire, I think there is an investigation that has been launched by the Western Cape government, a very extensive one, to determine the causes, and supported by the South African police structures. So that will, we don't have an outcome yet, but we will look at that closely. And then in terms of the preposition of resources, and specifically aerial resources, we have a system in place within the NADJOI structure and through the National Disaster Management Centre that when we receive these kinds of messages, that we already put the defence force or the aerial resources on standby. So we receive a request from the Provincial Disaster Management Centre, and based on the information that we get from the situation on the ground, we already put resources on standby, and as soon as it is necessary, it can be deployed immediately. In the Western Cape, there are already some of the aerial resources that are based in the Western Cape, so it can be activated very quickly, but some of the resources, of course, must come from Gauteng and other places, so that must sometimes takes time, because they must also manage the crew that must, you know, accompany the aerial resources. So it has been done with regards to the Western Cape, and what has happened then when the situation blew up, or not blew over, when there was another situation in the Eastern Cape, we have requested to extend the aerial support through the joint structures, and we redeployed some of the resources that was in the neighbouring area to assist in the Eastern Cape. So I think those processes are in place, and it gets done fairly quickly. But there must be formal instructions with regards to that. Just in terms of the informal settlements as well. The informal settlements, currently, as I said, the national departments are meeting today at the National Disaster Management Center to look at what kind of additional support can be given from the national perspective to support the provincial and local government structures. The Department of Human Settlements does have an emergency housing program, so they are looking into how they can fast track those processes. They are also having a visit tomorrow with the support of the National Centre in Leiden to look at the extent of the damages in the area. There was just another question with regards to Eastern Cape. Yes, the request for the briefing was for the Western Cape specifically, so we didn't want to include too much detail. But I can confirm that there is a team looking at the situation in the Eastern Cape. The fires were mostly in the plantation areas, and it was dealt with, except for the Nelson Mandela area, the Nelson Mandela Metro, where the school was burned down. But all the fires were contained. Again, there are flare-ups because of the wind conditions, and it is being monitored. There are resources in the area, but in the Sarah department district municipality at the moment, they still have issues with regards to water and electricity, and the team of COPTA is actually there today and tomorrow to look at how they can assist the municipality to restore those services.
Chair, thank you. Just a couple of follow-ups based on this, the last comments that Ms. Brewer has made. One of the issues that I encountered last year during the fires was that the National Disaster Management Center was unwilling to release resources until there was a guarantee of payment from either the local municipality or the Provincial Disaster Management Center. And that was, it wasn't here in the Western Cape, it was to do with Coga municipality. Now, my question is this. Has that been resolved? When we have issues like this, where we have disasters, surely we need to move the resources and worry about the payment after the fact, rather than saying, well, I need to get a security of payment from XYZ municipality before I will let helicopters travel down there. That's the first question. The second is, with regard to particularly SANDF resources, there are army bases all over the country. I think, for example, of the one at Oudtshoorn, where army personnel could at the very least be used as beaters or the like. Now, what is the extent of our relationship with the SANDF to utilize army personnel for that kind of thing? And also, you know, from an evacuation perspective, army vehicles, trucks, the likes, to move people and goods out of disaster areas. My final question, the front page of today's Daily Dispatch in East London talks about the fact that King Sabatadal and Diebo municipality in the Eastern Cape, which is Mthatha, has zero fire equipment available, zero fire engines available. Buffalo City Metro, for all that they like to say that they have 13 fire engines, currently has zero operational fire engines. And so my question is, how does the NDMC assist municipalities in A, providing equipment that matches a common standard, and B, ensure that they are ready for these disasters when they arise? What can you do to make sure that municipalities are delivering on their mandate for local disaster readiness in terms of having equipment, personnel that is properly maintained and available and ready to assist when these issues arise? Thank you, Chair.
Another member wants to make a call.
Thank you, Chair. I think mine would be on the food security issue. And I'll correct that to the DM. I haven't seen there were people who were complaining about the need of a permanent in order to be safe from where they experienced the disasters. I understand one guy came up just to say there is a pipeline in part of Nigeria where unfortunately it has been declared declared by national government but for those sort of wetland, but it's everything that he has. Then what is the position going forward in sort of seeking a good place to serve those people who are complaining?
Maybe just to start with a small addition from the previous questions. The school children from the informal settlements were affected because all their school uniforms and boots and everything were bent. The engagement was with the schools to allow them to come to school without uniform for a period whilst the relief was still coming. And they were allowed to go to school, and then relief came, and some of the
schools had additional books that they could then give to the children. But that has not been sorted out with the relief that has come. All in the able to step in. That is the type of response that went so very quickly and so fast. On the issue of the equipment by all municipalities to a particular minimum standard nationally, the current bill of the National Disaster Management, it's a bit not as strong and weak, and the minister is bringing and there are amendments that are on the way at the level of the cabinet to be discussed, and which one is going to be strengthening the capacity and the control and the emphasis on the minimum standard across the nation to be in place in all provinces and in all municipalities. And having visited and attended some of the international events myself, signed by the minister, we are learning that South Africa equipment and the systems of coordination and fighting disasters have to be improved, consolidated, and I think once that bill has expressed itself on those issues, we'll be able then to really marshal and ensure therefore that the equipment and the coordination element in it, because it's given to it all over, being coordinated by the National Disaster Center. So that will then begin to ready South Africa to be at least benchmarked as one of the best ones that bill has come in through. And the minister is taking note of that, and that is why the cabinet processes have started, and indeed it will then begin to together. But in the meantime, the minister will be engaging with the MECs of all provinces, taking a lesson from what has happened here in the Western Cape, and ensuring that's creating that. For them to really be able to go to each municipality and make sure that the ODQ and whether municipalities are fully funded have all these equipment, and then we'll be taking it in the mid-year as part of the report that we put there. And we have asked the Nyasaland municipality to even give us a report of that experience, and particularly the coordination, how that coordination was marshaled from health, all other players, the doctors, brothers, and so forth. It was a very good, nice model that we wanted to emulate, and it be a national model that can go to including the state of readiness and equipment to be in that particular aspect. Then the last one on the human settlement issue. I saw it also on TV. I'm not sure what is the heritage site declaration, but indeed, there are quite certain settlements in South Africa that needs to be revisited. By human settlement, by municipality, by government as a whole, because the low-lying areas are now under threat because of the global warming aspect, particularly in the eastern part of South Africa, the Eastern Cape. Already it's predicted that floods are going to be severe 20 years to come. And some of the areas, like in the Zimkul, the town is now migrating from the lower area. They are now shifting the town to the upper slope now, so that then when that river, which is next to town, the best is banks, is no longer going to be affecting the town. So we have to revisit certain settlements that are there, particularly in the rural area and also in the certain part of the country, to say they are now under danger and we need to resettle the people in a particular way. And obviously, it will then be part of those particular issues. There may be those that need immediate response, like this one has been raised. And then honorable member, and then we'll then be able then to then deal with those other emergency, and then like we are already doing currently in many cities and many towns, flood areas, so I'm moving to in the northwest. There were best of the rivers that happened in Rustenburg. Now the settlement has started to move them out of that particular area, and we'll then be responding to the immediate, but also begin to look at the long term aspects so that then we can then mitigate against the climate change or the global warming as is the case, because it's bringing certain disasters that the human beings must be saved, property must be saved, and including animals must be saved.
Thank you. Yes, with regards to the relationship with the SANDF, I think the National Disaster Management Center has a very close relationship with the with the SANDF and the SSDF. We are meeting regularly in the joint structures, and they also participate in our National Disaster Management Advisory Forum, and that happens across the provinces as well. So in terms of that support, it can easily be activated. We have processes in place. The disaster management legislation makes provision for the support of those structures. So it is a matter of making that decision and giving out a joint instruction, what they call. With regards to the situation where you refer to the payment, we have an agreement with the SANDF, so that usually there's not payment involved. So I think the issue that you mentioned was perhaps on the working on fire resources. So that is almost private resources where they do require payment. In the Western Cape, for instance, they have got a service level agreement with them. And I think Colin has mentioned some of the amounts that they put aside for that aerial support on an annual basis. So it is expected of provinces and municipalities to have those private agreements in place, which will entail funds. But from a national perspective, we work with the national resources, with the SANDF, and provide the aerial support through those arrangements. Then, in terms of the support to local municipalities, the National Disaster Management Center, we actually only have two people working in the fire setup, because we do have two pieces of legislation, the Disaster Management Act as well as the Fire Brigade Services Act. So you will remember last year that two years back we dealt with the Disaster Management Amendment, and currently the Fire Services legislation, the white paper has gone through cabinet, so that is the process that the Deputy Minister has been referring to. At the moment, we are doing capacity assessments of municipalities to identify those needs and to look at ways of how support can be provided. Unfortunately, the National Disaster Management Center does not have the budget to provide resources, but we do. Identify gaps and then present the municipalities with reports on that in terms of how they should strengthen their capacity. And we also have partnerships with private organizations such as Suntum with the Business Adopted Municipality Program, where they have also come on board to provide some support to some of the local municipalities that do not have adequate resources. Also, in terms of the provincial support, I think the Western Cape has set a good example in terms of how they have budgeted within their resources to support local municipalities in dealing with firefighting situations. And then, of course, the arrangements between municipalities is also very important. I think that was about it.
Our members is an ongoing preparation. Just imagine that the bill last year in amended.
Chair, can we ask that those capacity assessments that Ms. Brewer spoke about, that a consolidated report be generated and presented to this portfolio committee so that we can see what the status is of our municipalities with regard to disaster readiness and particularly fire readiness going forward?
The bill on disaster management was finalized. It's now an act. The act was amended. It was promulgated as such. The new piece of legislation that is being reviewed is the Fire Brigade Service legislation. And the white paper served before cabinet, and the process of the bill will start now. so it will come to this committee.
Is
it a different one? No, the fire brigade services comes back from 1987, so it's quite an overhaul that we will be doing.
Okay.
No, well, thank you very much for being very helpful. I think one of the chat was very helpful. She was always very helpful to do it. Number three.
to break us because we left the inner before the separation. No intention to have a compassion. You will just the presentation, after the presentation, we do have copies of ourselves. As we deal with the bill that is coming, we'll be able to speak for our function how we want to deal with the because we have debated some of these issues of traditional leadership is still there with us. Then so the purpose is to update us. What are the issues? And then the committee itself will apply its mind as we move on, analyzing the core and cell leadership, traditional leadership. That's what we're doing.
Charles, just to remarks, and then Mr. Abraham Sitole will do the presentations, particularly on the outcomes. We did meet in indigenous and traditional leaders in Dava with government and stakeholders under the theme Unity and Diversity, together moving South Africa for an inclusive and prosperous future. And in the main, the objective was to really begin to take up issues that always comes up in every debate that the traditional leaders have with the president when he opens the house every year. And I think this has been going on for years, from President Mandela to President Thabo Mbeki to the current President Jacob Zuma. And they will always be raising issues, but we felt therefore that this could affect time. Talk, discuss, understand, and on this particular issue. So we had four objectives that we wanted to ensure that we come out better informed, and so that if it's a policy matter, we could then begin to identify all those policies. The constitutional matters, we could then also look at those constitutional matters and so forth. One was the harmonization of relationships between the institution of traditional leadership, government, communities, and other sectors in general. The second one was based on the promotion of nation building and social cohesion in the context of Ubuntu. And then looking at the constitution, what it says in their home, and we had to tend to say, do we really understand this particular chapter 12? Constitution role and so forth. And then the third was the resolution of challenges around cultural practices that violate legislative rights of individuals and communities. Really to deal with now these issues that we best look at in the democracy, in the African system. Yes, they are cultural phenomena, but some of them, they are no longer they are in conflict with the current Bill of Rights and in our own constitution. And how do we then begin to arrive in the identification of such, so that we can then begin to engage and get rid of such, and no longer hide behind culture and when certain people do wrong things. And then the fourth objective was then the strengthening the role of traditional leaders in the radical economic development and land matters. And I think when you look at the resolutions, you'll be informed by some of this. So, Chair, as we said, that we are only presenting the declaration for now. The resolutions, according to the standard, is 30 days after the summit. So we are busy now processing, editing, and also taking them to the very house, because it was their endeavor, it's not the government. Government was just the facilitator. And hence, after we have done them, we then take them to the house of traditional leaders to then say, this is what you said. And then they can then begin to move. And resolutions are quite more involved in because they were, the engagements were robust, fair, frank, and there were other academia people who came in and spoke in the sense of the knowledge base so that whatever decisions that get taken, they are not emotional. They are well thought. And I think that has helped us in the 5 days that we have had with quite a number. And we also did invite political parties. Unfortunately, only two turned up, and the other two, having confirmed, they did not come because wanted also the traditional leaders to hear the voice of the political parties, you know, being public representatives, and then so that then there could be that gap closed between the distances that sometimes do okay. So only two of those loans had responded, and obviously going forward we will be developing an action plan after the resolutions have been looked at by the house itself to say this is what you said, this is what you said on the resolution. However, the declaration does cover four substantive resolutions that were there, and I will then ask Abraham to Mr. Stoller then to check in for an action number.
Thank you, Chairperson. Basically, the MS sum up the declaration. But just to go through the declaration, I'm going to start with the land ownership, tenure rights, and economic development as part of those that WDM highlighted earlier on. The first one was to reverse the legacy of apartheid that ensured the permanent loss of land of indigenous population. Government transferring 13% of land to traditional authorities within 6 months, and where there is no legislation, such legislation must be enacted within 2 years. Government undertake land summit to discuss the transformation of 87% of land parcel. The expropriation bill must cover the 87% of land and not the 13% that shall have been transferred to the traditional authorities. Effect moratorium on the acquisition of land by foreign nationals. The undertaking of land audit across the country for purposes of ascertaining the amount of land that rightfully belongs to the institution of traditional leadership. Utilize our land for socio-economic development. Support and enabling the capacitation of rural communities. Recognize rural-urban interdependency and the need for a more comprehensive integrated approach to urban and rural development. Ensure implementation of land tenure reforms and land redistribution within a developmental approach. The use of legal processes by government in consultation with traditional councils and communities to transfer land and register titles of all communal land that government currently holds in trust for the traditional communities. Then to suspend SPLUMA as it undermines the authority of traditional leadership in their areas of jurisdiction, and that the President of the Republic of South Africa issue a proclamation to this effect without delay. Establishment of a land commission as a Chapter 9 institution. Hold regular report back meetings with our communities to keep them abreast on land issues. Expand socio-economic opportunities and activities towards the creation of economical and self-sustainable traditional communities. Develop a model for a radical socio-economic transformation once necessary research has been undertaken. The model will be tabled to the institution for further engagement and adoption. Two, under nation building and social cohesion. Accelerate the statutory recognition and participation of traditional Khoi and San leaders in government programs. Promote nation building, harmony and peace amongst our peoples in their diverse form. Promote the principles of cooperative governance in our interaction with all spheres of government and organs of state. Harmonize relationship between the institution of traditional leadership, government, communities, and other sectors. Foster continuous engagement between executive authorities in all spheres of government and traditional leadership structures. Strengthen the participation of traditional leaders in municipal councils and other governance structures. Eliminate cultural practices that violate legislative rights of individuals, especially women and children, and communities. Promote an efficient, effective, and fair dispute resolution system and a fair system of administration of justice as envisaged in applicable legislation. Promote freedom, human dignity, and the achievement of equality and non-sexism, and establish regional and continental relations through the National House of Traditional Leaders. And this was referring to the SADC House, the Continental House, where traditional leaders of the continent will come together. Institutional capacity and support. Ensure that the dignity of traditional leaders is restored through the provisions of equitable support. Promote ethical, accountable, and committed leadership. ensure that traditional leadership structures advise government and participate in a process to strengthen the legislative framework. Constant engagement with the Remuneration Commission for Public Office Bearers to review the remuneration structure and enable traditional leaders to effectively perform their functions. Establish pension and medical schemes suitable for traditional leaders as public office bearers. Make budgetary provision for the training of traditional leaders and royal families, as well as for the benefits of spouses and widows of traditional leaders. Integrate the induction program for traditional leaders and municipal councillors, and ensure that government makes available the necessary requisite funding for infrastructure development for traditional structures. 4. Constitutional and legislative mandate. Reconstitute the structures of traditional leadership, ensure the establishment of Ministry for Traditional Affairs, review the legislative status of royal family, ensure that the National Department of Traditional Affairs to uniform implementation of the legislative frameworks by provincial government, ensure further engagement on policy-making process regarding the Traditional Courts Bill, and ensure that government commissions the compilation of African customary law. So all the above will culminate into a program of action that the Deputy Minister spoke about earlier. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, this is just the summary, I must say. The resolutions are quite detailed, and I think they could go up to 50 pages because of the in-depth discussions that took place. And in it, obviously, there's quite a provision of a thought that had gone through, and I know that you are disadvantaged as a portfolio committee now just to be receiving a summary of a declaration. And I fully concur with you that maybe to note there might be just maybe one or two questions, but to know them and allow for when the resolutions are there, then we can go and the different questions.
I thought that would be difficult to have a very intelligent discussion on the declaration. The declaration, a very brief statement of intent, and the resolution that has been prepared. I think one resolution I presented, then we can have another discussion. Hopefully, those are not going to take 2 years.
The resolution
must come, because some of the areas that you are raising in the resolution may also assist us in normalization of the current situation. That they must be.
Yes,
I had to show you in a medical area.
I just want to ask who is going to be the title holder of the land? Because we are talking here of transferring titles. Is it the community individual members or the traditional leaders?
Chair, just a very quick point. First of all, thank you for the presentation. I appreciate it. I'd also welcome the comprehensive report. I'd like to go through it in a lot more detail. But my question is, does the department support this declaration of intent and these resolutions as they stand? Because some of them are contrary to legislation. I'll give you an example. Spluma. That Spluma must be suspended. You know, Spluma was an act that was passed by the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform in 2013, and it was part of an extensive consultation process. It went through the NCOP, it went through the National House of Traditional Leaders. Everybody bought into it. Now this Indaba is saying that it must be suspended. What I'm asking is, does the department support these resolutions, or are they saying these are the traditional leaders' resolutions, we will present them for discussion? I just want to get clarity as to their position on this matter.
Are you advocate?
I could be. Could be a traditional leader, Chair.
Okay.
No, on the issues of the title deed,
they are saying that the title deed, currently the land is held in trust by government since 1930, with a 6%, and 1936 with a 7%, it has always been held in trust on their behalf. And then they have been managing it since 1913. Up to now, they are still managing allocations and all sorts of things through the traditional, well, from tribal authorities then into the new system called the traditional council. So now what they are arguing is saying, why don't we just give this land to the traditional authorities, not to a traditional leader? The traditional authorities are so composed, I think there's an issue of the 60-40 now, which will then be later debated as to the structure and then so forth. And obviously, land is a national competency. So even if when you have to transfer, it still remains that, then there must be conditionalities. So it means obviously at that point, if there's an agreement, I'm not sure what's going to be the reaction of government in engaging with the resolutions, whether there will then be, because there's going to be consultation based on this resolution. And maybe that also answers the other stuff to say, the resolutions are resolutions. They are going to be engaging government, they are going to be engaging various political parties. They will be coming and knocking on your doors to say, this is what we want. And there will be debate discussions. There will be also engaging with communities, where there are traditional communities all over, and it encourages on that consultation also to happen, so that these views, as their views, then can then go there and get resonance from the people on the ground and see if indeed there will be a swelling agreement and support on those particular issues. So the title deed, therefore, will go to the traditional authority, not to the individual. And within that setup, we then see the security of tenure, which is an absent element now. It ought to be part of that, so that people living in the traditional land or communal land can also enjoy the security of tenure like everybody else in South Africa. What form, what system, obviously those are the discussions that the land reform is already agreed before, I'm not sure that before Parliament, that it's engaging on, and then it will be a debated bill that will then settle that particular issue. So that even when at the point when you transfer the security of tenure is a package of that particular transference of land. And then also the other systems of occupations that the then reform is bringing, one householder, 1 hectare type of settlements that are also being proposed in certain other pieces of legislation. So that will then become a collective response to some of these issues. So the individual families will still enjoy their security of tenure, and then families will definitely be, I mean, traditional leaders themselves also on the piece of land that is on, but then the authority management of the land and the use will then be that. And any law, therefore, that then comes in on the special land and utilization and so forth will be governing the utilization of the land as transferred or not transferred, or as managed as is currently the case. So let's then wait for the resolution that then begins to speak exactly on those issues and see if you will be satisfied that they had applied their minds and their thoughts. But obviously the engagements will still be opening where they will be engaging with the report. Second one on the Spluma.
I just use that as an example. I mean,
Okay, but let me then respond to it nonetheless. Yeah. The dispute has always been there even when the president was about to ascend it into law. They have always been raising objections, and maybe the president will say, well, I'm not happy with this piece of legislation, don't sign it. And the president proceeded to sign it. But then later, when the submission was made by the traditional leaders to the minister, then the president then established an interministerial committee that is already in place now. And then will then be meeting with the steering committee of the National House, so that then they can then begin to look at those issues that they've raised and that they've been raising and that were ignored at a particular point in time to find a amicable solution. Their call was repealed in the conference in the Sindaba, and we had to come in and say, repeal is rather too much
to call for. And then they then said, we have ignored our amendments, so we are no longer trusting you when it comes to this amendment. Then the suspension was the settlement formula that says it will be suspended only in the communal land space, not all over as they had intended to. Only the communal space, suspending for implementation so that municipalities do not now go in and grab and do as they want, because in their own view, their functions and powers are diminished or not even expressed in that piece of legislation. And then a municipal manager has been given the power to annex and do anything with that particular land. And fears that they've been expressing are as that. So the steering committee then will then be meeting with them and then to find a formula until such time that there is a resolution. So they had to then express as they did that the president must then forgive a proclamation suspending only on that area rather than the entire legislation being approved, which was a very good, sensible arrival of a commonality after engaging and debating. So I don't know how it will work in terms of the law, whether it's doable or not doable. Wow. So we just left it there as a resolution, the intent, and hoping therefore that the steering committee might even fast track its work and making problems like that might even avoid other actions being called. However, they did say that if this, when you go to the resolution, if there's no amicable resolutions, they'll call for the repeal of the legislation. But I don't think we'll even reach to that point where there will be amicable. And in Limpopo already, they've designed a new law based on Sukluma. That satisfies that. So the Limpopo traditional leader says that we are happy, we are fine. And then, but, and others say, hey, why only Limpopo? Why can't it be a uniform standard for all rather than every province coming with all its piece of legislation based on the main legislation? So I don't know. That is what then Limpopo has noted as a good example, but wait. Can we then go to a formula that satisfies everyone rather than allowing Limpopo then to come with legislation? And the legislation in Limpopo is just simple, very, very simple. It just defines their roles. And that was it. And that's what they're asking. Define our role so that we are not being sidelined and what have you. And Limpopo just captured those texts and everybody said, and I think if we could just listen to the text yourself and the particular point from them, we could then hear them. Very, very simple, doable things. It's not a complex matter. And it's just that section that they're quoting. I'm not sure of the section in the Luma that they're quoting. Section 3 of the law. That's all. In Section 3 where they are not meeting. And I think that's the matter that we could end with that. So it was just by one of the examples that Luma, because he chose Luma, honorable matters.
No, the question was, given support to this kind of intent.
Remember, this is a traditional leaders summit facilitated by government. These are their resolutions. And then we do give support to the resolutions as taken as intent, because in the resolution there's going to be engagement. There might be things that we arrive and agree with, and there might be issues that are complex or difficult, depending on the issues as well, and whether this issue provides or it doesn't provide. So, and those are the issues that we take it and so we take it to cabinet, we take it to various committees, and how the president is going to handle the whole issue, then depending whether there's going to be another incident that is the substantive nature of it, but there's going to be engagement. Parliament will be taken on board, but obviously we have insisted that communities also must be taken on board so that we could then begin to look at those issues. And the land 13%, they said where there are no disputes, because there are little pockets of land within the whole communal land, that some of them are under the CPAs and others are under other form of other trusts. And then they say not yet, those they will talk about them at some point as a resolution. But the 13% is the only one that they say. Why? Because we are already managing it. Why don't you just give it to us and then we continue managing it and whatever laws that gets elected so that they do their do's and don'ts on that particular. And they say the legal process is the one that needs to be followed. They did and success on the legal process.
No, I think, colleagues, we are going to debate this matter on resolutions. Resolution will be coming very soon, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
They will come before we finalize coins and traditional leadership. Because if they come after we throw with it again, it will be a resolution. They may be very helpful for that part of work. It was an all-inclusive enough for traditional leaders from Koyan Sands, everyone were there. And then, of course, there will always be dispute in some traditional areas. They will look at it. I think, colleagues, the statement of intent is very clear. We are going to receive, the secretary will receive a bubble stop. The secretary, once the report is finalized, I think we can give it to us in confidence. I don't think, because we attended also. We need a copy, not before it's approved, but even if before it's approved, because we attended and participated, we need a copy, the secretary will have a copy. If we do that before the end of July, it will be a great thing. Because by August, when we deal with the coin side, and then if you bring it to October, it won't be helpful. And then I think we should do that faster. Very thankful for the presentation. Of course, we are there. That MSC, I know that of course are there. We are trying whatever best. But it seems they are shifting, though. When you look at the statement of intent, for them now to agree on the question of non-sexism and then the gender issues, it seems they are changing. Amakhosi never talk about women generally. It seems there is change. Let alone that, as they said that in their statement, they should also accommodate the legislative areas around human rights areas. And I think it's really a great achievement for Amakhosi. India was very fruitful as that, far as that is concerned. We'll then go back to the discussion and the solution are there. That discussion will also assist us for the entire team. Let us really adjourn the meeting. We are meeting tomorrow at 9. We are going to be the very beginning time. We are finalizing just the whole the secretary is going to allocate that legal services. I think it's GEMA, all those work with us. And then we can meet with her also finalizing this. It's not going to take time. It is 1 hour. Doctor, it's 1 hour. I think on your side you said it's 30 minutes. Yeah. And then I think we should do it that way and finalize it once and for all. Tomorrow we adopt it and then the entire process and stuff. I think it would be fair for us to adjourn the meeting and prepare for tomorrow. Thank you very much.